Welcome to the XYZ Experiment podcast. In the studio today, it's Darsh and Fiona, and we have a very special guest, Dr. Minto Felix, newly graduated PhD. And I'm so proud because I know Minto because I taught Minto when Minto was an undergraduate student. Just shows my age. Even though Minto's also a Gen Y. Welcome to the podcast, Minto.
Thank you, Darsh. Hi, Fiona.
Hello. It's so lovely to have you today. Minto, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Firstly, thanks so much for the opportunity to come and have a yarn with you. I am also newly 33, so yeah, living in London. And I've been here for 7 years, but with a few kind of stints back in Australia, substantive stints back in Australia in that time, which is where I'm, you know, substantially from. Although I was also born in India, I'm sure we'll pick up on different aspects of that life journey shortly. But yeah, working in consulting for a firm called NAS Group that works with government and community and other organisations towards, you know, a vision of positive influence. I just finished my doctoral studies in the space of higher education and research, looking at the role of culture and how culture is shaping the aspirations and motivations and working lives of researchers in the Indian context.
And so, as we said, you belong to the millennial Gen Y generation. Minto, what is the most Gen Y thing about you?
That I can still remember and really valued having a home PC and, you know, playing video games, not that I played that much of it, but, you know, being able to get up on a Saturday morning in Australia and watch, you know, the Rage music video on ABC and, you know, sort of consuming television and culture in that kind of hardware form. Consuming art felt like a physical experience.
That is such a good reflection, actually, because, yeah, you're right. Like, there was a physicality to the home computer, the home TV. Everything had a place and you had to be in that place.
Minto, what made you move to England to study and work? Why that move and what inspired that decision and what were you hoping to discover or achieve? And had you planned to stay that long?
You know, I wish I could say that I had a strategic foresight about what kind of life I wanted to have. And, you know, within that, moving to England was a key part of that kind of foresight. It was not. It was largely accidental with a little bit of that, ooh, what if, and following your nose about things that I was interested in. And that's kind of been perhaps the only thing that's really been consistent in that time. But it was sort of a confluence of different things that happened. I was working at the same institution where Darsh taught me on some really interesting pieces of work to do with public health and education and other things that I was really passionate about, working for a really, really terrific leader who invested and encouraged my abilities. And basically there was this opportunity to come to the UK to look at a specific question. And at that time it was around the mental health of university students and what universities were doing in the UK to address it, how they were working with healthcare providers to address that challenge. And basically I came on that experience in March of 2018 and had the chance to travel across the UK to see what different institutions were doing. But also through that process, I was able to see the UK, see a bigger world, a very different kind of context with similarities to Australia. But like, it kind of just sort of blew my, you know, mind in a very, like, you know, I feel very naive saying it now, but I was like, oh my God, the world is quite big and complicated, and there's lots that we can learn from each other across systems, across countries, across ways of life. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, if I could have an adventure here? As someone that identifies as a migrant, I moved to Australia when I was 7. By the time I was 18, I think we'd lived in about 13, 14 different homes. I've moved schools a lot. You know, moving was exciting and daunting, but also was like, felt entirely possible.
Yeah.
Because I've done it all my life. And so I was like, why don't we give this a go? And so I made that move. And then basically what happened was I came here with a place of, with a role lined up. We can maybe come back to it. But then I sort of was like, what if I studied more? You know, and I did my put into further academic study. And then that became, what if I did a PhD, and, you know, sort of just followed my nose, what if I did this? And then suddenly it's 7 years. But I kind of also feel like I've had one foot in lots of different places.
Wow.
In that time.
Because I'm just wondering, Minto, it is very much a millennial thing to go overseas for work and study. Were your friends doing something similar at the time, or were you the only one who kind of made this type of move at the time?
Others had paved the way. I had predominantly at that time friends that had moved to New York. I was doing a lot around social justice and anti-poverty work. And a lot of, there was a generation of those friends that had moved on from that kind of work to like the change.orgs or, you know, UN or consulting in New York. And I was interested in that for a while, but I think this experience sort of reoriented into the UK. I had one very, very close friend that had moved to the UK and was enjoying life. And actually I spent a fair bit of time with her while I was here that first time. And sort of there was the professional, like, whoa, you know, I could contribute more and sort of the that perspective of it. But being with her also was like, oh, wow, there's so much more that I can experience as a person in terms of she is of a similar ethnicity to me. We grew up, our families grew up in very similar ways. And, you know, she was finding it a really freeing, liberating experience. And I was like, that could also be really cool and wonderful for me. So I think for me, it's probably bigger than that. I think it's my family, it's my parents. You know, they had already set the example of moving. I mean, I sort of think I'm 33 now. When I moved, I was 26. When my parents moved, my mom was 28 with a 7-year-old and a 16-month-old. I mean, and that is kind of insane when I look back on, you know, just me trying to find matching socks every morning. I sort of think that is like quite incredible. They sort of just set that as, you know, something that I think that we could do. So I think that's probably a bigger driver of confidence or kind of self-belief in being able to make the move.
Were your parents really responsive to you making the move as well, or were they saying, don't go? Like, what was happening with your folks?
My parents they're people of many tales. They have always been so supportive of my vocation, of work that I have been interested in. They've never really fully understood it, that I really need to. They have just been so encouraging. They've sort of also been very pragmatic around, you know, doing doctoral study overseas as an international student. They recognised the significance of the opportunity that I had, but also like the financial realities of how they could or, you know, were not able to support. So they were very clear about that and what I would need to do to sort of get myself up and running. But they have only been encouraging of my pursuits, and therefore they were like, go. Equally at the same time, you know, it is just the four of us, including my younger brother, in Australia that, you know, they were obviously gutted to see me go. But as I keep sort of referencing this, in the 7-year period, I have actually been in Australia for close to 18 months. Mm-hmm. I was back during COVID for 8 months in 2020. I was back living with them for 5 months in 2023, working on my PhD, and then again 4 months in 2024. So I also think that they've seen plenty of me. That time, my granddad passed away in 2022 and I was doing field work in India. And so, you know, we spent quite a bit of time during 22 and 23 in that part of our world as well. So I think as a family, we're quite used to being all over the shop.
These opportunities that you're having, these things that you're doing, would there have been a possibility staying still in Australia? Was it the move really important strategically for you to get all these opportunities?
Yeah, I've never thought about it like that because I'm sort of looking at Dash because, you know, we've seen each other, you know, over that time professionally quite a bit. I think I, as a person, am driven and kind of purpose-oriented, and I think I could have, you know, continued to do really interesting work in Australia. Australia has a lot to offer and so many important questions that we tackle across a whole range of fields. And also, I feel very fortunate to have had some amazing mentors, and it's not like I would have not had the chance to learn or be stretched or challenged in that culture context. But what I think your question makes me reflect on is, as a person, would I have had the capacity to, you know, to sort of really think about my identities, to really form, I guess, and live a more global perspective, even though Australia is very diverse. I don't think I felt encouraged or comfortable within myself to really, you know, push the different parts of me, whereas I've had the opportunity to almost do that with that, not consequence, but in a more kind of liberated way in the UK. So I think it's those opportunities, academically or professionally, I'm not so sure it would have been all that different. Mm. But I think as a person, I'm so glad. And that I did not have the foresight that would be the case. And maybe that's still a big part of the reason why I'm still here.
Do you still feel like a tourist in the UK? You know, like when I moved to Melbourne from Perth, I felt like a tourist in Melbourne for years, like years and years, and in a good way. Like, it was so exciting to explore things. Do you still find that in yourself?
Yeah, yes and no. That feeling of, you know, excitement, new places, new, you know, there's a new cafe or a new, I don't know, performance or whatever. Yes, that's really exhilarating. But I think all my life I felt a bit like a tourist. You know, in the sense of no one place has ever felt like, oh, this is fully my home, or this is where I'm going to be forever, just because I've not really known that. You know, even while I've been in the UK, I've sort of moved around so much because of study. I've lived in London, lived in Oxford, come back to Melbourne. And so, you know, there's that. But what I've learning through that process is, for me, home is not a place, or, you know, that feeling of, you know, I'm from here is not a place, but maybe something that I create for myself, in particular with the people around me. You know, home is where your people are. So I kind of feel like how lucky, I didn't always used to feel this way, believe me. You know, up until the age of about 16, where I would be like crying one way to a flight to India and then back to Australia, like, where am I, you know? Whereas now I feel like, wow, how lucky am I to inhabit these multiple homes, where I do feel a sense of deep connection.
That's incredible, because I have heard people talk about being a global citizen and feeling at home globally. And I feel like you almost were touching on that. Like, I feel with your work and your research, it is around global challenges and issues, and to be able to appreciate that, to be able to do that, to be able to breathe it, live it, you kind of need to also be that. And so maybe that's also what you're resonating with.
I think that is probably what I embody. I have a tattoo, which my parents don't know about just yet, which I've been meaning to get for about 10 years. And it was an inscription that I saw in the house of Nelson Mandela, where he got arrested in Joburg. And it says, Muntu Muntu Lubuntu, a person is a person because of the people around them. And that quote just really animates me, animates my attitude towards people, towards work, towards the questions that I'm interested in.
I feel like that's a really millennial thing as well.
Do you?
Yeah, to have the tattoo that really means something to you. No, I do. Like, it's really nice to have something like that, and it really means something to you. Every time you see it, it must really motivate you.
Totally, Maddie. Yeah. That's why it took me also a long while to sort of get it done. But you're so right, I think, because I see now, you know, young people that are probably the next generation, or even towards the end of this generation, it's sort of funny, and that's part of it too, right? Or it's a memory or whatever. But for me, you know, I'm also someone that feels things very deeply and thinks about the time. And so, yeah, I'm not surprised that's it. Do you have tattoos, either of you?
No, but that's because my mum won't let me. Like, she was anti-tattoo, and I was just, and then by the time, and now my husband is like anti-tattoo. So.
Oh, okay. I have a very good friend who recently asked me to come and get a tattoo with her, and I said no. I said, but I'll come with you. I'll come, you know, get what you have yours. And I said to her, why did you ask me? And she said, oh, I thought you're the one friend who would do it as well. And I'm like, no.
That's really funny. But, you know, have I lived in Australia? I mean, it's hard to say, but, like, one of the reasons that I took so long to get it was definitely, you know, mum in my head. You know, I was able to get it done. Having said that, my brother got 1 year before I did. And he just went out and did it, and no problems, you know, at all. And I remember mum calling me, it was about 5 years ago, and she was like, oh, your brother's just done this, and, you know, he's done it, okay. And I was like, oh, that's all it was. Yeah. It was just nothing. It was not this dramatic thing that I probably internalized anyway. But I think it is sort of relevant in this conversation, because I think it also says something about, I'm the eldest in my family, you know, as an immigrant also, like, I think you feel the weight of responsibility to be a good son and do this and the whole Indian thing. And so I think that's, you know, that probably made it a bigger deal in my head than I really needed to be.
But the rules are always so much stricter for the oldest. There's no doubt about it. You do all the rules and the younger one breaks all the rules.
Totally. Yeah. For me, I know that one of my strengths and shadows is perhaps, like, you know, a hyper fixation on being like the model son, or, you know, being kind of, not perfect is not the right word, but probably is in that realm, you know, by a number of different standards. But actually, again, living in the UK has allowed me to embrace a lot more of an imperfect life and sense of self, which is really, really, I think, important as well.
You mentioned, I think, at the start that you did have a job lined up when you went over. Is that the same job you have now?
Oh my God, absolutely not. I'm really grateful that's the case. What I will say is I had about 4 years before that at the place that, you know, Dash and I knew each other from, which was so charmed, had so many great mentors. Of course, you know, frustrations at work all the time, but, you know, worked on things of significance and sort of harnessed that experience to get this next opportunity to come here. And it was the most destabilizing experience of my life. I had to learn some tough lessons about my own kind of work self and habits and things like that. But also, like, it was not an encouraging, safe place for me at all. And also I was having to face this experience on the other side of the world within the first 6 months of my time here. And I was like, eek. But actually it taught me a lot about, you know, picking yourself back up, you know, really, you know, being clear on what is and isn't for you. And yeah, it was actually a really, really formative experience. And off the back of that, I sort of rediscovered the place that I'm currently at, where I've been at now for 5 years. It's been incredible and inspiring since then. But one of the things that I learned in that period or through that experience is, you know, as someone that's very driven and kind of committed towards issues of purpose, I think we can sometimes kid ourselves into thinking that it's just what you do that matters, you know, the really interesting intellectual challenge or whatever. But actually it is absolutely the case that it is how you do that work and who you do that with that really, really matters as well, I think.
I really love that, how you do it and who you do it with.
It's making me think about, you learn from the hard stuff, not the good stuff. That's what you learn from. And each time that something's really hard and you overcome that hardness, then your brain is ready for that next level, that next challenge, you know what I mean? But it's tough when you go through it, especially if you're on your own in the UK. That would be pretty tough.
Yeah. It also made me realise how perhaps resourceful one can be in reaching out to their networks, in asking for help, which is not something that, you know, I'm always very good at doing, and sort of recognising that, you know, okay, this experience didn't work or this kind of relationship is not serving you, but don't forget about all the other things that do serve you and that perhaps are the spaces that you should lean into.
Great message. Now, you do work in consulting, and I think people have particular ideas about what that is as people who might not work in consulting. I'm just wondering if you can share, what is it? Is it what you thought it was going to be? You know, maybe kind of give us a little bit of an insider look into what the consulting world is like.
I'm actually really surprised that I'm in management consulting, because my first grant opportunity was in management consulting. And I remember going along to the induction day and quickly realizing that, oh, you know, there were some really bright, ambitious people in the room, but they were very happy to work on things that they weren't actually interested in from a values perspective. And also you know, that it wasn't really a place where they could find community. And I was like, oh, that, those things are actually quite important to me. And I sort of shifted gears. And it was because of circumstance, basically, that I was trying to find a way to make the PhD happen while not being broke and doing things that I cared about, that consulting came back up. And I do think there is something about this particular firm that I'm at, the values, the kind of philosophy that's at the heart of it, the clients that we work with and the types of problems that we work on, that has set this experience apart. Like, I'm not sure if I'm sort of overstating the kind of value proposition of my current employer, or, you know, if actually it is the case that consulting has many aspects to it, and we sort of hear about certain things in the media but don't really, you know about other aspects of it. But, you know, I have this beautiful Venn diagram of being able to work with clients that I really, you know, think are doing important work in society, using my skills both in kind of facilitation or leadership development, as well as kind of, you know, strategy. And I have a pretty good work-life balance, and, you know, I'm comfortable to live a life in London in these cost of living crisis times, with really, really caring, fun, brilliant people that I sort of feel like I'm not sure if this is necessarily reflected in all consulting, but, you know, I'm in a sweet spot. But that does not mean that I will necessarily do consulting forever. I think I'm still purpose or issue driven, rather. And so I think that right now it's enabling me to do a lot, learning a lot, you know, really interesting. But I've sort of, you know, never know what's around the corner, other things that you sort of want to do in life. Sometimes I sort of think maybe I want to give everything up and just sort of, you know, open an Airbnb.
Can I ask you, what issues drive you? You said you're issue driven. What does that mean?
I think, and Dash would probably know, in fact, it was actually Dash that mentioned this quote to me in a public health.
Oh, gosh.
Tutorial many oh nearly what are we yeah we'd be nearly like a, more than a decade ago now, which is, you know, very, very funny. She said that, you know, most consequential decisions around health in people's lives actually happen outside the health system. Mm-hmm. Not sure if that's necessarily a data point or if that's an established kind of public health paradigm. It's probably a bit of both.
It's an established public health thing, but yes, yeah. I did say it in a lecture.
He really kind of clarified how I think I see the world. I wrote a piece for the ABC many years ago on the back of a Q&A episode, and the title of that piece is "A Healthy Nation is an Accepting Nation," and it was around kind of the consequences of discrimination on, you know, vulnerable communities, but also equally the opposite of, you know, what would an accepting, inclusive society do for, you know, people's lives and well-being. That's it's a bit broad in kind of a mission, but I think the kind of things that I'm interested in is how can education shape healthier, happier lives? How can working on issues of advancing diversity and inclusion contribute to people's sense of life and optimism and community? So I think it's really that kind of bubble of work that I'm really interested in. I think we're living in times that are deeply divided and so polarized, and where, you know, we still have these strong men, and I use that term deliberately, running the world, who also strike me as men that perhaps, like, just aren't very self-reflective, maybe, or, like, you know, have they actually worked through their traumas? I'd love to sit with Trump. You know, think about, you know, who's your inner child, you know, and how does that shape the values of your policies? But I think there's something about, you know, if people have the tools to look within, to examine their biases, to think about the prejudice or lack thereof for others, what would that mean for our overall health and well-being as a community?
You mentioned, like, the world leaders at the moment. And at the moment, what's your perspective on what good leadership looks like?
Okay. well, I can't really say that there's heaps that pop to mind when we think about the kind of Western world order. However, I saw a trailer for, I think, an upcoming documentary about Jacinda Ardern.
Yes.
In a little while. And, you know, it sort of references her famous speech about, you know, I am kind, I am sensitive, I am anxious, but these are all the things that, you know, allow me to be a more empathetic and compassionate leader. And she was not without fault, of course, as no leader is. But I think she modelled not necessarily what I would be espousing as the should be the dominant leadership paradigm, but to model a kind of counter to the dominant leadership paradigms that we see. And I think that we need to sort of think about, you know, leaders as what do we need from our leaders in terms of behaviours or kind of philosophy to meet the great challenges of our time. The great challenges of our time are more interconnected than ever before.
Mm.
The great challenges of our time are rooted in inequality. And so do the leadership characteristics and behaviours match that moment? No, I'm not really sure. I think there's also another book that I'm reading at the moment, which is given to me by a terrific friend, is The Descent of Man by Grayson Perry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about kind of how the world is built around the default man. And it has been structurally, behaviourally since the beginning of time. And that is not to discredit the contributions of men and traditional notions of masculinity, which have served a purpose since, you know, the Industrial Revolution. But to ask, you know, is it still serving us?
Mm.
Is that kind of thinking and the kind of, you know, rough and tumble approach that we want to create?
I almost feel like we spent the last 10 years saying, you know, recognising more DEI stuff and being more inclusive and recognising people are different. And then it's almost like we got to the point where we're going, this is fantastic, we're recognising everybody now. And then the world went, oh no, that's enough. Let's close this box. This is too much now. Which it's crazy. It's like we're going backwards at the moment. Just seems crazy to me.
Yeah, and I think also in sort of building on your kind of sort of description of the situation, which I agree with, is we've said everyone's different, but I think that's just basically made everyone kind of vulnerable and hot and bothered and sort of exist in their own camp of, well, I'm different, or I have experienced this injustice, or that kind of triumph, you know, and that sort of plays into the wokeism kind of mentality as well. Instead of thinking about, well, that's not the point. That's not the point at which the job is done. The job is, well, how do we come together to learn from each other, to be more respectful, to, you know, to support one another? Like, I don't think it's, you know, I don't think I'm espousing an idea that's rooted in any kind of left or right ideology, because I think you can create narratives in all and other kind of frames, but it's to ask the question of, you know, how can we support each other to, you know, get the best out of each other? Because isn't that really the point? I mean, I sort of think about the fact that we just don't have that much time, you know. I mean, I know I'm taking the ring, but I don't feel like I have that much time to sort of, you know, I'm not going to swear on this podcast, but, you know, I don't want to F about, you know. I want to sort of, you know, just enjoy life and get on. And, you know, even within that, you know, we never know what's around the corner. You know, I had a very close friend's mum pass away earlier this year at 59, who meant the world to me and, you know, shaped so much of my life growing up. But you sort of go, wow, you know, and that was a really good person. They lived a good life. They set an outstanding example for their community and were fun. So, yeah, you sort of re-examine what's really important.
Because I often look at a lot of leaders and I just think, why are you so angry? Why are you so angry? Like, what's there to be so angry about? Just seems
egos.
To be so much anger at the moment. It's crazy.
Yeah. But I like what you were kind of saying, because I think sometimes when we focus too much on differences, we don't see how we're connected.
Yes.
And we're in the midst of a highly disconnected society where all we see are differences.
Mm.
Not how we're similar or how we can come together. And I don't know if we have world leaders who have as you said, are self-reflective enough to be able to be like, I can see the person and something deeper. I don't even know if they see it in themselves, to be honest. Like,
Yeah. I mean, I struggle with it too. And I think that the social media, for all of its benefit, I think has made the situation worse. Empirically, I'm not quite convinced that, you know, we found a way to make it work for, you know, in support of those values. The same friend of mine that I mentioned gave me the book about masculinity also said the other day, you know, social media is making our lives and our worlds feel bigger, our communities feel bigger than it is. And I think there's something in that about, you know, we are performing for almost like the stage.
Yes.
You know, or we are consuming insights and perspectives that, you know, are so disconnected. But what does that mean for the depth and the quality of our close relationships, or how we're able to kind of form a strong sense of self? It's quite a, you know, it's like, I don't know what the analogy is, but it's kind of a bit like walking in the wilderness, I think, when it comes to social media.
Oh, it's wild. It is.
And I sort of think, like, thank goodness I grew up with the hardware stuff. But then, and thank goodness, my early experiences of life is growing up in a kind of, we call it a colony. I don't know what the politically correct term is, but it's basically a community of houses in a U-shape in India, where all the kids would play together, there'd be music, parents would be sharing food. It was just, everything was done in that way. That was the base. And then, you know, even when we moved to Australia, you know, it was, of course, you know, mum and dad were helped, you know, they were the creators of the family unit, but we were raised in community, you know, through sport, through activism, through faith and so forth. And, you know, even that did not necessarily, that was not enough to help kind of challenge the questions of conflict that one goes through in forming their identity. I just think, how much more challenging would that be for the young generation of today? I mean, I was struck by the kind of insight that, you know, Instagram, for a 16-year-old, that removes 5 images of their kind of their recent selfie or whatever, Instagram automatically, the algorithm directs them to sort of take up plastic surgery or cosmetics. That's so scary.
That's so
wild.
Scary.
And I'm not absolutely not anti-cosmetic, but what I'm saying is, like, that's what we're creating a society around. Like, that's quite heavy for a person to work through.
Yeah.
I've seen 2 things about the younger generation that have really interested me this week, and I think are interesting. But when you go to a disco or a club, kids don't dance anymore. They'll hop onto the dance floor, but all they do is a very, very sort of moving up and down, but they don't dance. And the reason being, they think, is because someone might video them, put it onto social media and ridicule them. That's why. And they're saying disco's dying. Because of that. And it's the risk of someone ridiculing them and making fun of them and putting that up for other people to see. And I thought, wow, you know, like, whereas like my generation and a lot of your generations as well, we didn't have that. There was no video evidence
of
it at all.
Nothing was documented.
Yeah, yeah. And that would be tough. And the other thing I saw about younger people is someone was asking advice for Gen Zs about what would be the greatest advice you'd give to a Gen Z. And they said, literally, learn to talk to strangers. Because they said all their communication between themselves is all, they never phone each other. It's all texting, texting, Facebook, Instagram, it's message, but they don't learn the art of conversation. And that's a hard thing as well.
I'm guilty of this too. When I go out and I spend time with my friends, but I know that I need to be more mindful and get a better handle on it, because you're right. You sort of really, you do 2 things. You are not present. You are literally not present to the life that you have worked so hard to live and experience. And also, your actions might be led through from a place of shame. We don't want that. We want to feel pride when they go out to have a dance, to be silly. That's a really important part of the human experience. And, you know, I absolutely hate. This sense of curated, life that we seem to want to perform for others.
So with your consulting, do you find with the clients that there's anything that holds them back because of this sort of stuff that's happening nowadays?
Yeah, not so much directly. I mean, I suppose for a lot of our clients in both the public sector and in the context in which we work, artificial intelligence and its role in delivering public services, education, health services is huge. So I think there's that question, but also, you know, it is an opportunity as well to create more opportunities for people and to deliver better services. I know you do a lot of work in that space as well, Dash. So I think that, I think that's a question. Yeah, it comes back to, I think, what we were talking about earlier, Fiona, and you're kind of at the heart of your question about leaders is, what are the values that are the basis of the kind of communities that we want to create?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And are we actually designing the world around that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So true.
Thank you.
I do want to talk to you about your PhD because it is incredible. So tell me about the journey to doing a PhD, your research topic. Like, what drew you to this research topic?
I'm glad you're excited by it because, of course, I'm excited and I'm grateful to have the opportunity of having, I think, sort of a melting of all of the things that we've spoken about today, culture, identity, how education can help solve problems and build new understanding, and also my own personal experience working across these different kind of living life in different contexts. But basically, it is asking the question of, how do scientists and researchers in the Indian context, how do they experience that activity? How are they supported to do research? What are the things that hold them back? Are they able to focus on the kind of questions that are important to them and to India's own sense of self-determination, while also recognizing that the kind of science and research enterprise is within a global framework? And started the inquiry with very much kind of a practical policy focus of how do we improve India's research and science system. But actually, that's the wrong question. Or it is only a part of the question, rather, because what's more important, I think, that I've sort of tried to argue through the work is how do we understand this idea of culture and science and research? It's not just about socioeconomic ideas. It is also about culture in the types of organizations or intellectual communities that people are a part of. It's that culture that's shaped by disciplines. You know, the world of the computer scientist researcher is very different to that of someone working in archaeology. And those things and those ways of working lead people to different destinies. So it's not about forcing and kind of getting India to sort of think about its science and research through one lens or one kind of culture and, you know, put your policy and investment to sort of making that happen. But, you know, in my mind, it's about recognizing that India is not even one country.
Yeah.
You know, it's a multitude of traditions and perspectives and lives. I mean, even within my own family, I've got cousins that speak French, cousins that, you know, that speak in that grew up in certain faith traditions, and cousins that are diaspora, you know, all of that kind of stuff, that makes it more important, I think, to consider India as a nation of multiples, and therefore its research culture and that too as, you know, as having multiple possibilities and visions of excellence.
I've always thought the people of India found education very important. Would that be a correct assumption?
I think so. And the expression of that education, which we now might expect India to sort of conform to a global order that where the tone is set by Western institutions. But, you know, India's knowledge traditions are very old, very ancient, very diverse.
Mm.
And, you know, there's kind of evidence of medicine and mathematics and language that is, you know, far, far, far richer than we, you know, might give it credit for.
Mm.
So again, it is something, there is something here, I think, about encouraging different possibilities, because also that's at the heart of science and research. why are we obsessed with getting, you know, universities to all look and sound the same?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're expected to run, and we've got real choices to make as a society about the kind of system that we want and, you know, the kind of goals of higher education research, whether it's to produce graduates or it's, you know, address research commercialization needs. And, you know, but we mustn't lose sight of the fact that this is a really kind of complex and multi-layered endeavor. This idea of education, higher education and research. It is about original knowledge. It is about doing things fundamentally differently. And to enable that, we've got to encourage people's capacity to innovate and ask questions that have not been asked before. You know, we've got to be a bit more dangerous.
Yeah. And I do think in this current climate that being dangerous and disruptive and risk-taking is very hard, maybe not always encouraged thing to do. So it's a really good point that you make.
Yeah, it's not seen as a starting point.
No.
It's rewarded for being the exceptional. Well, that's we should be flipping that around. We should be encouraging every talented scientist, research team, no matter where they're from, what discipline they're working on, to ask dangerous questions.
Yeah, I love that. To, I guess, circle back as to why we got you onto this podcast to talk about, you know, your work and study overseas. And we don't know what the next generations are going to do in terms of this. But what would be your honest advice, your sage wisdom, I guess, to anyone who is wanting to take the leap and study and work overseas?
I'm not sure if I am necessarily in any way qualified to provide wisdom of that magnitude, but I'll share with you something that was shared to me, which is this idea that you must be uncompromising about your goals or your vision or your personal manifesto, and I think also need to spend time thinking about what that is and that's really important too, but be totally flexible about how you get there. Mm-hmm. There is no way I knew, you know, what I was going to do when I came here to the UK, or the questions that I would ask, the people that I've met, the mistakes that I've made, but I've had this sort of sense of these are the ideals that I'm working towards in both my life and what I spend my time doing. So I think getting that balance right is really important. And I think the other is sort of to come back to the tattoo point. We are the sum of the people that we surround ourselves with. And I have felt so fortunate that I've had people think, as I get older, deliberately so, that push me to think differently, that encourage aspirations, but also, you know, you recognize that some will be there for you and evolve with you, and others you will grow out of, or they will grow out of, and that's okay. That's, you know, that's great. And to be discerning about who is for you as you're trying on different shirts through life is really, really important. But I think those two ideas have served me so well so far. And let's see what happens.
Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast, and don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.